May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Alan Taylor. The trial court committed several errors in this case, each of which standing alone amounts to reversible error, and certainly taken together requires this court to reverse Mr. Taylor's conviction. The most essential evidence the state had against Mr. Taylor of his involvement in the shooting was the out-of-court statement of Stephen Saunders. And despite the fact that it was coerced through an unlawful arrest, threats, and lies, the trial court permitted the introduction of this statement under 3507.
I'm interested in your comment, coerced, as you explained. The explanation I understand is that this is just a routine interrogation tactic, and that it's not as if we're looking at someone who's ordered to go without food or water for hours or beaten with a rubber hose. And these are all adults, yes. Right? They can figure out what's going on around them. What is it that makes you conclude that the coercion rose to the level that it constituted an involuntary statement?
First of all, under Brown versus Illinois, I would point out that investigatory detentions are actually more condemned than those where the suspect, that the police have probable cause. Now, in this particular situation, the reason that it was coerced is after 2 hours of denying 26 times that he did not know who did the shooting, the police officer stepped out of the room, came back in, lied to the witness, stating, "I just spoke to the attorney general, we're charging you with murder," and cuffed him to the chair. He unlawfully arrested him for murder, upon which he had no probable cause to do, and lied to him, he acknowledged that at trial, and cuffed him to a chair, leading him to believe that if he doesn't give him the information, then he can't be released. It goes on and is more specific than that, and I think that the witness's response to that...
Well, before you, as I understand it, in addition to that, he said, "You're going to go to jail for life. Someone else will grow up calling your children daddy." And the defendant started crying, and when the questioning resumed, not the defendant, the witness. And then at some point the witness said, "What do you want me to say?"
That's correct. That's correct. He did say that. And the officer gratuitously threw in, "I want you to tell me the truth." But he also stated things like, "Stop, I don't want to hear that," when the witness actually made statements. Whenever it didn't match what the officer wanted to hear.
So does the record reflect that after 2 hours, the statements that you think are problematic were all given at a time when the witness was handcuffed to a chair and thought he was under arrest for first-degree murder?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that the first 2 hours were also, he was also questioned without Miranda, and he was in custody at that point. However, specifically the point that he was cuffed, certainly from that point on, yes, it is in fact an involuntary statement.
But my question is,
I'm sorry.
Where the statement, I understand that you think the whole, do you want the entire statement excluded or the statements that were made after he was questioned having been placed under arrest for first degree murder?
We would ask that the entire statement be excluded, and in the alternative, if this court concludes that the coercion began the moment he was lied to about being arrested for murder, then certainly that portion of the statement should have been excluded.
Well, the trial judge saw a tape of the statement?
Yes, he did.
How could he have gotten it so far wrong, based on the way you've explained it?
I don't understand. I don't know the answer to that completely. I can say that he did not assess all the factors. If the court were to look at his decision, he looked at factors such as he wasn't beaten. The officer gave him a moment to collect himself. He didn't look at the fact that he was arrested unlawfully, that he was not read Miranda, that the officer actually did, in fact, lead him towards the direction he wanted. He didn't even address those factors. And he also didn't, when discussing the threat about the children, as Justice Holland pointed out, it wasn't just a threat, "We're going to take your children away." It supported the threat, and the officer conceded at trial, it was a threat that he would be charged with murder and be in jail the rest of his life. The minute this witness said, "Mr. Taylor did it," They uncuffed him, and he was never charged with murder. And at the beginning of this...
all of this factual background, including the videotape, was seen by the jury? Did the jury evaluate all of this as well?
Yes, they had a redacted version, but yes, they had these portions to assess the voluntariness aspect.
Was it argued to the jury that the statement was involuntary?
Yes, I believe it was.
And the jury apparently rejected that?
On a factual basis, apparently they did, in the context of all the other evidence that was presented to them.
And you're not challenging the jury's verdict on that ground, are you?
Well, it's a legal jury.
Yes. Could make that conclusion?
Certainly. If they don't know the law, yes.
Well, if you have a jury deciding that it's voluntary and have the judge deciding it's voluntary and your argument that it's involuntary and that there's a basis to conclude it's involuntary, why isn't this within the range of alternatives that we give deference to the trial judge to make?
Because there'd be no purpose to have the judge make this determination if we were just going to leave it up to the jury. Certainly, if the judge found things that were voluntary and the jury found it was voluntary, there wouldn't be any issues with respect to this. The judge has to make a legal conclusion. The judge is the one that knows that if you're not given Miranda, that takes away from the voluntariness. The judge is the one that knows that if you're cuffed and told that you can't, that you're going to be charged with murder and there's no probable cause, that takes away from voluntariness under the law. The jury makes a factual determination. And the court, in the United States Supreme Court, in Brown versus Illinois, addressed a situation almost identical to this, where the quality of the arrest was the purposefulness for investigative purposes.
Well, what is our standard of review of the factual finding that the statement was voluntary?
The jury's?
No, the judge's.
The judge's is whether there is, it's a question of fact review to ensure it was supported by competent evidence. And the court has to, the trial court, and the court uses for 3507 statements the same standards that are used when addressing the defendant's statements. And under 3507, again, putting this in context to 3507, this was used as affirmative evidence against my client. And so when the jury is permitted to hear evidence that is legally should have been excluded because it was involuntary, the fact that they make a factual finding for whatever reason that it was voluntary, then, and we don't know, quite frankly, whether they did that or not, or whether they based their decision on just strictly what they heard. And in the United States Supreme Court cases, they make it clear that one is not to look to the actual content of the statement in determining as far as whether it's credible or not to determine its voluntariness. And we don't know whether the jury took that into consideration. They heard evidence of guilt.
Are you asking for some type of bright line rule, or do you think the U.S. Supreme Court has already drawn the line? Because there are a lot of cases from the United States Supreme Court that say you can lie to a person when you're questioning them, including the defendant.
That's correct.
But here, what the lie was that you're under arrest for first-degree murder.
Right.
So are you advocating that if you lie to a person about being under arrest, that's quantitatively different than anything you say after you lied to about being under arrest makes it involuntary?
Yes, but I don't think a bright line rule is necessary, because the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, Frazier versus Cupp, as well as this court, has held that whether an officer lies to the witness is relevant. Okay, so even though it doesn't per se make it involuntary. So he did lie about other things as well in this case. And the fact that it was so egregious, I would argue, it weighs heavily in favor of finding that it was involuntary. If you cuff somebody to a chair and say, you're being charged with murder unless you tell me what I want to hear, and I say things that I don't like to hear, and I tell you, stop, no, I don't want to hear that. You saw him kill that fucking boy. Stop. That's what he was told. And then he said, but tell me the truth. When he would say something, he would then redirect him. And furthermore, the witness's response can't be any clearer that he was coerced. He broke down hysterically and repeated several times, even after he was cuffed, I don't know who killed that boy. I don't know who killed that boy. I don't know who killed that boy. And then came to a point where he said, what do you want me to say?
So are you suggesting that any time someone cries during a statement that that shows coercion?
No, Your Honor. I think it is a circumstance to consider. And I think if the court considers the entirety here, where he was arrested by a swarm of four police cars, supposedly for a capias, was taken into custody, and the state acknowledges he was put in custody, not given his Miranda warnings, pestered for 2 hours and stuck to his gun, so to speak, then was told, you're under arrest for murder. Certainly, in that particular case, yes, that is a significant circumstance. It's not a bright line, and certainly just because someone cries, that does not make it involuntary.
Was Sanders charged with any offense either in this proceeding or some other proceeding?
No, he was arrested for a capias with a domestic violence, and I'm not sure, but it appears from the record that he had some type of charge, perhaps in family court or CCP.
He wasn't implicated as either a principal or an accomplice in this?
No.
Help me understand this focus on coercion and involuntariness. And I ask the question in this context. We know that both the judge and the jury, the judge initially as a fact finder and lawgiver for the purposes of determining whether the statement was voluntary, involuntary, and whether the jury should see it or not. But he and the jury saw everything that is relevant to your argument and had to have concluded that factually the witness wasn't coerced. Now, we have to deal with that. We understand the standard of review. I want to focus on your argument that there's some added legal significance here that the trial judge did not deal with in his ruling on the voluntariness, and that is that because the police lied and said that the witness was under arrest for first-degree murder when, in fact, he was not, he should have been given his Miranda rights. And had he been given his Miranda rights, we can extrapolate that perhaps he would have concluded to say nothing at all. And
right.
We wouldn't be here today.
Right.
Now, what is the relationship between the absence of that consideration and the failure to make the Miranda conclusion that you would have us reach, and the fact that on these facts, 13 people said, we see the tape, we saw what happened when he was asked and when he answered, and we don't think he was coerced. What's the relationship?
Okay, to answer your first question, Miranda issue, the Fifth Amendment issue, and the voluntariness issue actually go hand in hand. Typically, the Miranda issue is a predicate to the voluntariness, and that is a significant factor in the voluntariness assessment, which the trial court did not consider. He also did not consider that he was falsely arrested for murder. With respect to Your Honor's question as to the jury's finding on voluntariness, we have to remember the jury was also subjected to other evidence, first of all, that was erroneously put in front of them, and considered that evidence with respect to the testimony of a couple other people and perhaps the corroboration by cell phone records and comments that were inappropriately made by the judge.
Okay, your point is, unlike the judge, they didn't consider the facts focused on voluntariness of Saunders' statement in a vacuum.
Right. Yeah, and I think that goes back to my earlier statement that that actually, when the jury's placed in that situation, they tend to also include assessment with respect to whether or not they believe what he said in part of their voluntariness analysis, which is not what they're supposed to do, but there is that danger when you're dealing with the jury.
Was the jury instructed on voluntariness?
I believe they were instructed in this case as to the voluntariness, yes.
Well, help me out on that. Would the instruction be that if you find that this statement was not given voluntarily, you should ignore it?
No, I think the jury is supposed to actually give it the weight that it thinks that is appropriate. I have to be perfectly honest. I don't have that in front of me, and I probably should
have. Okay, I guess what I'm wondering about or troubled about is that it seems to me there are two different parts to this problem. One, you can't use a statement if it was involuntary, right?
Right.
But two, even in an involuntary statement can be factually correct.
Correct.
So if the jury sees and hears the statement, arguably they might say, wow, you know, this guy was really forced into giving these answers.
Mm-hmm.
But sounds like ultimately he told the truth, or we're going to believe what he said.
Right.
So I'm not sure how it all works in terms of the jury's determination that it was voluntary. All that we know is that the jury determined that they were going to believe what he said.
That's correct. And that is much more artfully stated than what I was trying to state earlier. And that is, the jury makes these layperson decisions that it looks like it's true, even though they beat the crap out of him, even if that had happened, then they may consider that in their decision-making.
Well, that's not what the... I'm looking at A-147, the jury instructions, and the judge said, if you find that the individual's will was so overborne by the conduct of the police that the statements produced were not the product of a rational intellect and free will, then the statement was not voluntary, and you should not consider it. So they were instructed to disregard an involuntary statement.
Right. I don't think that relieves... it takes away the problem that we have here. Again, the fact the man said something that a jury doesn't have the law of what coercion and all that means, and the fact that they consider that in the context that this looks like it might be the truth takes away from that. And
but at the end of the day, we don't have a jury determination on voluntariness. We have a guilty verdict.
Right.
So then the question becomes, was there other evidence, assuming they concluded it was involuntary, could they have decided to convict anyway?
And the answer to that is probably not. And specifically, they had three witnesses. One is Mr. Smith, who didn't identify anybody as the shooter, and then two young ladies that carried with them significant credibility issues. And they were buttressed by the cell phone records, which should have also been excluded. But in their case, the one woman went to the police shortly after the shooting and said, I don't know who did it.
But there are two issues. I know the one you're going to. You contend that Sanders' statement, certainly if it was inadmissible, could not constitute harmless error.
That's correct.
But for the purpose of my question, when we're trying to see if what weight, if any, we can attach to the guilty verdict, we don't necessarily know that the jury concluded the statement was voluntary. The only thing we know is that the jury convicted him.
That's correct.
And these witnesses that you say are problematic, the jury might not have decided were problematic.
Correct. But we don't know that. And I think the court, when there's a harmless error analysis, it's the court has to conclude beyond reasonable doubt that there was no harm here. And I don't believe that can happen.
So what you want us to do is go back to the Chief Justice's question where the judge is the gatekeeper and say, as a matter of law, the statement should have never come in, whether or not the jury could independently determine its voluntariness.
That's correct. And that actually, I believe, goes to, if we take ourselves back to the context of this, is 3507, and it is a foundational requirement, just like asking whether they've told the truth or not.
Ms. Walker, I think Justice Holland, I think, put his finger on the problem. And the problem I have is that if we were to rule your way mm-hmm. on the voluntariness of the statement as a matter of law, then there would have to be some legal rule that would constitute the holding in this case. How would you articulate it?
Well, I would articulate it that the court is to look to the totality of the circumstances, and certainly when you have a police officer falsely arresting someone for a crime which he has no probable cause that he committed, and holding it, physically restraining him until he actually gives him the statement that he wants.
Those are the two circumstances that should basically nullify the admissibility of that statement as a matter of law.
Yes, I would add one more, and that is while he was cuffed, physically cuffed, the officer led him clearly to where he wanted him to say by not just listening, by not asking questions and getting answers, by telling him, stop, I don't want to hear that, and directing him to what he wanted to hear.
So the three circumstances.
Yes.
Well, now you've reshuffled the deck. And missing from the deck is the failure to give a Miranda warning.
Yes. I would add that as well.
Four circumstances.
That's correct.
And I'm still confused about the Miranda warning's role here. On the one hand, he's falsely arrested, therefore he really isn't arrested. There's no real intent to follow through with that, but he believes that he's been arrested.
Right.
Give me a case that says Miranda applies.
Well, I can't give you a case on the specific circumstances.
But Miranda sounds like your one bright line rule. If you didn't give Miranda under these circumstances, anything he's asked and answered after that is out of the picture.
Yes.
Regardless of whether it was voluntary
exactly.
or involuntary, it's just per se involuntarily
yes.
because he wasn't given Miranda.
That's correct.
That's a pretty important fourth.
Yes, you are correct, and I apologize. I'm not very articulate this morning. But the Miranda is, there's two ways to go with this. And one is that under Miranda, there's a bright line, and I think in my reply brief I'll make that clear, that that's as far as they have to go. They falsely arrest him. They had no basis to arrest him. And under Brown versus Illinois, when the arrest is unlawful, everything's excluded. When Miranda is not given, everything should be excluded. Under voluntariness, then we consider, the unlawful arrest and all the other circumstances involved in that.
And your position is the trial judge never addressed the Miranda issue?
That's correct. Or the unlawful arrest itself.
And it was raised?
Yes, the total, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Unless you have any other questions at this time.
Well, you've got some rebuttal time left. Okay. We'll think of something else. Trust me.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the Court, Maria Knoll representing the State of Delaware. In this case against Alan Taylor, the State presented witnesses from four civilian witnesses that were there at the time of the shooting. They included Stephen Sanders, Raheem Smith, Anya Bailey, and LaShelle Kent. During the course of the trial, the necessity of 3507 statements came into play, especially in the case of Stephen Sanders. With respect to Mr. Sanders, the court took an afternoon break, watched the video of Mr. Sanders, and the following day, after argument between counsel in front of the court, the court issued a ruling from the bench stating that the 3507 statement was voluntary. And specifically stating that, the court stated that under the totality of the circumstances, there was no physical intimidation in this case. The detective did not interview the witness while he was crying and or upset. He did not tell the witness what his answers were to be, and the court stressed that. That there was no evidence of police overreaching, and based upon all of those factors, the court determined after viewing the entire three-hour statement.
Well, why isn't it overreaching to tell someone that you're under arrest for murder and handcuff them to a chair when all of that's false?
Well, Your Honor, under the case law as I understand it, and under the totality of the circumstances, that is just one thing to be considered. First of all, when the police officer did come back into the room and handcuffed his arm, he didn't say, you're under arrest for murder. He said, you are under arrest. That was the exact words. At that point, the witness broke down for about approximately 2.5 minutes and then composed himself and never cried again. There was a rational discussion between the witness and the detective. The detective did not raise his voice, and they continued the discussion, and at that point, the witness answered the questions.
Without having been advised of his Miranda rights.
That's correct, Your Honor. He was not advised of his Miranda rights. But in this particular case, the statement is not being used against this witness at trial. He's not the defendant here. Miranda applies when you're using the statement against that person.
But the witness didn't know that. That is, the witness believed, as he was told, albeit falsely, that he was under arrest for murder. Had he been advised of his Miranda rights, he might have refused to proceed further with that interrogation.
It's possible, Your Honor. However, again, Miranda does not apply in this particular instance as it's not being used against this particular witness at trial. It is 3507 analysis for voluntariness. And yes, Your Honor.
Your colleague would suggest that, okay, you may be right about that. It's not the defendant attempting to suppress a statement, an alleged confession, let's call it in the vernacular, that's going to be used against him in his trial for homicide of whatever degree. But it is coercive, the thought is, to tell someone that they're under arrest for a serious felony and not to tell them that they don't have to talk to you. You're left with the impression the only way you're going to get out of this is to implicate someone else. Her suggestion would be that was never really dealt with specifically by the trial judge, and the failure to do so is an error, is error, reversible error. Would you explain that?
Yes, Your Honor. While I understand that, the court did determine that the voluntariness inquiry, and he did state that whether the behavior of the interrogators was such as to overbear the will of the witness to resist and bring about a statement that was not the product of rational intellect and free will. He did indicate that police tactics are allowed. He did indicate that he took into consideration the police tactics. While not specifically saying the word Miranda, he did watch the entire video, including the police tactics, and said that the police tactics were acceptable and found that under a totality of the circumstances, it was a voluntary statement.
Well, is there anything you can think of that the police could do that didn't involve anything physical? Well, put aside the handcuffs in this case. But is there anything they could ever say that would result in a statement being involuntary? Or are we at the point now where you only make an involuntary statement if there's some type of physical coercion or deprivation?
Your Honor, I think, again, it is the totality of the circumstances. There is no case that I'm aware of that says one act in and of itself makes a statement per se involuntary.
I understand that. But I want you to know, to answer my question, mm-hmm. in the mix mm-hmm. of the totality of the circumstances, what could the police say that would tip the balance?
To make it involuntary?
Yeah.
Your Honor, I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I suppose they could threaten to hurt them.
Well, let's take a real-world case. The police say to an individual, if you don't answer our questions, we're going to take your children to family services and you'll never see them again. That's happened.
That has happened.
Does that rise to the level of what Justice Holland's talking about?
No, Your Honor.
Without any other knowledge of any other circumstances surrounding the way the statement was taken?
Your Honor, no, it does not. And I believe the case is, Flowers versus State. That particular witness, Ms. Suler, was the detective threatened to take her kids away if she didn't give a statement and cooperate.
What if the police said, you're under arrest now for first-degree murder, and we're going to seek the death penalty if you don't answer our questions. And should that happen, then your children will definitely be calling someone else daddy.
Well, I have to say, Your Honor, that is certainly more egregious than this particular case.
To rephrase Justice Holland's question, what is it that the police must do in order for their tactics to be deemed the cause of an involuntary statement in Delaware?
I honestly don't know how far they are allowed to go, Your Honor. I do know that the trial court can make its independent determination on voluntariness.
Well, change the facts completely.
Okay.
Let's suppose a trial lawyer is taking a position in good faith, supported by the record, and the trial judge says, if you don't change your position, I'm going to hold you in contempt. And there's no basis to do that. The judge isn't going to do it, and the lawyer changes their position. Has the lawyer voluntarily changed their position?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe they have. The job of that person is to do their job and do it correctly, not to, respond to threats, to do something erroneous.
So you're saying if the lawyer does change their position after that false representation of contempt, they've changed their position voluntarily?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that they should, they would stand their ground otherwise. That's also a voluntary act. Anything a person does, for the most part, under most circumstances, is a voluntary act.
Well, can you comment on Lynham versus Illinois, 372 U.S. 528? Isn't in that case where the police said children would be placed in foster care and the defendant would lose custody after she served jail time? that the Supreme Court found the confession was involuntary?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I am not familiar with that case. I am familiar with the state of Delaware's cases, which had both a situation where somebody was threatened with going to jail if they didn't cooperate, Brown versus State, where this court found that it was a voluntary statement, and also Flowers versus State, where she was threatened to have her children taken away, and the court found that to be a voluntary statement.
Were the threats there, among other totality of circumstances, considered?
My understanding is yes, Your Honor, that the totality of the circumstances, the threats themselves, the length of time that the person was interviewed, the amount of times that the person did not want to respond to the questions. I believe the court indicated that police questioning was reasonably calculated to obtain her statement. Their job is to get a witness to talk, and that is what the police did.
The other side seems to contend, although she did not use this phrase, that the factual conclusion of the trial judge that the statement was voluntary is just plain wrong. Why isn't it wrong?
Your Honor, if you were to review the statement itself, there is no physical intimidation by the police officer. The police officer is speaking at a normal level throughout the entire case. He indicates a number of times when, Ms. Walker was stating, he was telling him to tell the truth. He even said, don't lie to me now because that could cause you problems in the end. He was very nice to the witness the entire time. At some points, the witness was belligerent towards the officer, but the officer was not belligerent towards the witness. It was just a long statement where, after reviewing everything, including the time that he was cuffed and the times that he wasn't, that it was a voluntary statement. And the court gave it a careful analysis on the record after both argument from both sides and reviewing the entire statement.
Right. Well, in the defendant's brief on page 11, the defendant says, when Hall returned, he immediately cuffed Sanders to the chair, said that he had contacted the Attorney General's office and was going to charge him with murder. And then there's a citation to the tape. As I understand it, you're contending, if we read the tape, he's going to tell him, you're under arrest. He never used the word murder.
Correct. I reviewed the statement a number of times yesterday. What ended up happening is cuffs him, says you're under arrest. Witness starts getting upset. He tries to calm down. He says, I know you didn't shoot anybody. And then when the witness starts talking, he seems to indicate, if I tell you what I was doing at the time, are you going to arrest me? Am I going to get in trouble for it? And that's when the officer says, I don't care if you were cutting drugs in the middle of the street. I don't care what you were doing. I want you to tell me what happened.
Is there a transcript of the interview?
There was not a transcript done, Your Honor, no. The interview was entered as a court exhibit.
Did you want to address any of the other issues?
Your Honor, I would like to address, just with respect to the investigator, Brian Daly, the cell phone expert. That was brought up in Ms. Welker's initial brief. In this particular case, the investigator from the Attorney General's office, Brian Daly, reviewed a number of cell phone records that were entered into evidence by the state through the Nextel expert, through the Nextel certified record custodian. The investigator reviewed those records and was able to establish a timeline that a cell phone that reportedly belonged to the defendant traveled from Wilmington approximately 25 minutes after the homicide to the state of New York that evening and then ended up staying there, and then the phone was shut off. The state went through a Daubert hearing in front of the judge on the second day of trial, and he found after the Daubert hearing that the credentials of Investigator Daly were sufficient to establish him as an expert to testify with respect to the evidence that he was going to be providing to the court, which is mainly how he mapped the cell phone towers and got to the locations. Mr. Daly was able to do that. He was able to use both of the keys as well as plotting maps on the computer in order to establish that timeline. The appellant suggests that Mr. Daly was not qualified to make these determinations, despite the court, after a Daubert hearing, deciding that he was qualified.
On that point, I understand the state's position to be that it wasn't necessary to even put on an expert in order to establish the facts regarding the cell tower tracking. Is that correct?
Your Honor, it seems as if the states are divided. In this particular case, it was necessary. It is outside, just slightly outside, at least at this point, the realm of general knowledge how to map cell point towers. However, it is easily something that could be learned. This particular investigator went to school and was taught how to do this for a multitude of hours.
Okay, so you're not contending that expert testimony wasn't necessary?
No, I'm not contending.
You're saying it was necessary, but your side fulfilled all of the evidentiary requirements.
Yes, Your Honor.
Second question, was that expert cross-examined, about his technique and whatever before the jury?
He was cross-examined, Your Honor. He was subject to cross-examination by the defense, both in front of the judge and then at a later time in front of the jury. With respect to his qualifications, they were sufficient. It was fairly simplistic, and what he did have to do, and he was able to explain it in a way that the jury was able to understand and the judge was able to understand, so it certainly assisted the jury in understanding how he reached those conclusions. He did not make any determinations as to ultimate issues at trial, ultimate facts. He just basically put out that information so that it was understood by everyone that this particular phone was traveling the night of the homicide and the next days. Your Honor, appellant has raised some other issues. Is there any other issues that the court would like me to address?
Do you have any comment on, even if the evidence supported the defendant's nickname, of all things, to have been murder, why it was necessary for it to be mentioned by the prosecution in either an opening or a closing statement, giving the nature of the evidence?
Giving the nature of the evidence, Your Honor, it was necessary to establish his nickname as being murder. In this particular case...
I'm not talking about entering the evidence that effect and the jury hears it. Mm-hmm. Why would you mention it, thereby creating an issue on appeal in either your opening or your closing statement?
Your Honor, it was simply mentioned to establish that Alan Taylor is murder. You're going to hear the name murder, and we wanted the jury to understand that that is the same person. This was an identity case from beginning to end, and identity being a clear issue, it was meant to only establish identity.
Was it mentioned in closing?
I'm sorry?
Was it mentioned in the closing?
I believe it was mentioned twice in closings to the effect of Alan Taylor, also known as, to make sure that it was shored up that the two names were the same person. There was no suggestion that, his name is murder and therefore he's a murderer, nothing like that. It was simply to say Alan Taylor is also known as murder. Three out of the four witnesses only knew him by that name. If you had said to them, can you point out Alan Taylor, they would have said no. If you said, can you point out murder, they would have pointed out the defendant. They did not know the name Alan Taylor.
Was there any alternative suggested by anyone, such as, well, let's use an initial or anything along those lines, so that particular nickname is not referenced?
No, Your Honor. The indictment did not have the nickname. At the beginning of the trial, the defense pretty much conceded that it was going to come in, as they knew used the name a number of times as well when they were questioning witnesses. So the judge fashioned a cautionary instruction that was given at the beginning of the trial saying that the name murder is simply to be used for identity. And that was how the case was presented from the very beginning. I wanted to address one other thing. Ms. Walker indicates that the most essential evidence in this case was Mr. Sanders' statement and seems to suggest that there was no other evidence pointing towards the defendant's guilt. There were other witnesses in the case. Some were 3507, but notably there was one witness, 17-year-old LaShelle Kent, who testified from the witness stand numerous times that she identified the defendant. She said he was shooting. He was the only one shooting. He was the only one with the gun. And after he shot the victim fell and died. So to suggest that the most essential evidence in the case is Sanders' statement seems to leave out the eyewitness testimony from the stand.
So your point is that even if there was error in admitting the 3507 statement, it was harmless?
If the court decides it was error, yes, it was harmless. There was other evidence pointing towards the defendant's guilt. This was not a case where Sanders was our only witness. The trial lasted a good 9 to 10 days of evidence presented by the state pointing towards the defendant's guilt.
Going back to my earlier question, I'm looking at page 7 of the brief the state filed in this case, your brief, and you're quoting at length the trial judge's ruling after he reviews the tape statement. And in that, the trial judge says, at one point in time, Detective Hall tells the witness he's going to be arrested for murder, and the witness breaks down. So the trial judge was under the impression the witness was told he was going to be arrested for murder.
He may have been, and that's the analysis that he used, Your Honor. I was just trying to clarify what was said when you look at the statement, it says you are under arrest. He obviously took that away as him being told he was arrested for murder, and then still under that analysis determined that it was a voluntary statement.
Okay. Well, is it possible that a little bit earlier the interrogator had said, if you don't cooperate, you're going to be arrested for murder, goes out and comes back in and says you're under arrest?
Although it is possible, Your Honor, from my review of the statement, I don't recall it as that. I believe when he had left, it was to determine whether he may or may not give a lie detector test, and then he came back, and that's when that conversation ensued. It was made clear that he knew that the witness was there and that the witness knew from the other people he had spoken with, that the witness knew and was there at the exact time of the homicide and was friends with the actual defendant. So that was made clear, that he was at least known to be with them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I guess Ms. Knoll and I have been watching different videos, because he certainly does say you'll be charged with murder. And I have also watched it several times, and I don't think the judge would have out of whole cloth made up that the charge was murder. I'd also like to correct her representation of my argument. I never said there were no other witnesses who identified him. I said they had significant credibility issues, and I didn't get a chance to actually go into those credibility issues. But they were significant enough not to be able to overcome any harmless error analysis.
Well, could you focus on the witness who says she saw what happened and
certainly
saw him shoot her?
17-year-old Ms. Bailey had, after the shooting, gone and talked to police and said, no, I didn't see anything. 8 months later, police go to prison, talk to Max Turner, who was also incarcerated at the time of the shooting, and said, hey, can you help us out here? He said, yeah, I'm going to send you two of my girlfriends. Two girlfriends come. One happens to be Miss Bailey, who says, yeah, I saw the shooting. And then at trial, she goes back to, no, I didn't see the shooting. The other girlfriend says during the statement with the officer, I didn't see anything. And then the officer reminds him, listen, you're here to help your boyfriend. And then she says, okay, I did see the shooting. So those are some very significant credibility issues with those particular witnesses.
Let me understand, did the boyfriend who was incarcerated get some time off or something,
yes,
some deal as a result of this?
Yes, I'm not sure what the deal was, but the record reveals that they did go to help him for that. What that deal eventually was, I'm not sure.
So are you saying they gave 3507 statements that were presented and that they distanced themselves from at their trial testimony.
Yes. Now, Ms. Kent did testify at trial consistent with her second part of her statement to police, but she did also have internal inconsistencies.
Well, what was the second part of her statement?
She said, she first said when she was talking to police, I didn't see anything. The officer said, you're helping your boyfriend. Then she said, okay, I did see the shooting.
All right, that's the second part.
Yes, I'm sorry. To go to Justice Jacobs' request for a bright line rule, I actually think if the court looks to Brown versus Illinois, 422 U.S. 590, 605, it states a very nice statement of what the law should be, and that states, the illegality here, moreover, had a quality of purposefulness. The impropriety of the arrest was obvious. Awareness of the fact was virtually conceded by the detectives when he repeatedly acknowledged in his testimony that the purpose of his action was for investigation or for questioning. The arrest was both in design and in execution was investigatory. The detective embarked upon the expedition for evidence in the hope that something might turn up. The manner in which the defendant's arrest was effected gives the appearance of having been calculated to cause surprise, fright, and confusion. And so I think the test that comes out of that would be when the police are using purposefulness to get information and the method that they did here, that is what makes it involuntary. Additionally, the state seems to also indicate that any time somebody changes their position in response to a threat, it's voluntary because they did it, and that simply would totally eradicate any voluntariness analysis.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Rise.